Good to be here with everyone today, and as you might be aware, we're going to do things a little bit differently than kind of the usual. We're going to continue with what we started last week, continuing into next week as well, framing our time around Hebrews 10, 24, and 25, where it says, and let us consider, right? Let us think about. Paul says, let us ponder, let us meditate upon. Let us consider how we may spur one another. That word spur can be translated provoke. I think better yet, it's motivate, right? And so let us ponder, let us think about, let us dwell on how we may motivate one another toward love. Love here is in the Greek agape, toward seeking nothing but the highest good of the other. And good deeds, right? Hands and feet, something tangible, right? A tangible expression of compassion and generosity, not giving up meeting together, as is the habit of some, but it says, let us encourage one another. Let us encourage one another. And I think one of the primary ways that we can motivate and encourage one another is through the sharing of our stories. And so last week, Teresa Gibson, if you weren't here, go back and listen to it online. You won't be disappointed. Teresa Gibson came and shared with us. And today I want to invite Sally Graydon to come on up and sit with me and have a conversation and kind of hear some about her story. As we're doing this, and Sally, if you want to grab that mic right there, that would be great. Just a few kind of questions to be considering as you listen. Maybe consider what resonates with me, right? What challenges me? What inspires me? What motivates me? And then with that, what as you hear her story, what maybe would you want to or what might you incorporate into your own story? Kind of absorb into your own journey. And then with that, ultimately, it's all aimed at moving us more toward love and good deeds. And so what might that look like as you hear Sally share her story? So, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm just noticing the lights.
Yes.
Do you stare at those every week? They're bright.
Well, they're bright. You kind of get used to them. And yes, it's tough up here. I know. Now you all know what I go through every week. Yeah, no, you just kind of try to look beyond them and see all the lovely faces out there. So, kind of as I did with Teresa, this is just a chance to kind of hear from you about your life's journey, and I'd like to start at the beginning, the where you were born, family, siblings, extended family, just kind of what are those basic facts from the earliest of days and months.
So I am a local girl. I was born at Good Sam in Portland. But when we were 6 months, when I was 6 months old, we moved down to California till I was 6 years old and came back up, did the rest of my growing up in Forest Grove. I was youngest of five in my family. The other four were all born within 7 years. And then 7 years after number four, I came along. So I was a blessing. youngest, but really more like an only child in a lot of ways, because I was home alone with my parents for a lot of years from the time of upper grade school on. And my parents grew up in the Depression. They were born in 1926 and 27. A lot of you have met my dad. He's in Newburgh, and he's here every once in a while. He's 98 now. My mom died 10 years ago this past Thursday, so she's been gone a while. And the Depression really made a mark on both of them. I heard those stories a lot growing up, both of them growing up very humbly, not a lot of means. And in addition to that, there was a layer for my dad in that of growing up in the Dust Bowl. He grew up in the Texas Panhandle, and as well as lost his mother when he was nine. So there, you know, it's kind of an epic American story, it seemed like, in some ways. But the depression, the things surrounding that, and the struggles and how it built them were stories that were big as I was growing up.
So how did that play out in your childhood? I mean, I'm also the youngest. I wasn't 5 years difference. And psychologically speaking, generally, you say from one child to the next, if there's greater than 5 years, it's as much you're an only child as you are the baby of the family. Mm-hmm. So you kind of had a dual experience there. How did your parents growing up in the Depression, how did that play out in your in their child rearing of you in early years?
I think very practically, there was not big spending. They were careful with their money. We were very practical. And I think also because it was a little bit emotionally distant, honestly, because they had grown up with hard things and you just went through them, you know, in those years, getting through difficult things. There wasn't time spent on how are you feeling and all that.
Yeah, I think that idea of scarcity, and so you hold on to things maybe a little more intentionally, and also, yeah, everything's hard, so mm-hmm. you just got to push through it. So what kinds of things, hobbies, activities, did you play with your siblings? Did they play with you or friendships? What were your early years like?
Yeah, my siblings always, all of my siblings were great older siblings. I always felt very loved by them when they were around. I played more with my best friend that was a block away. She was my main person that I learned how to be with peers with. I otherwise was around adults a lot and knew how to relate to adults, didn't think of them as different at any time in my growing up. And as far as activities I did, of course, I took piano lessons from time I was seven, always had a cat, liked my bike. But as I was thinking through the different questions, I realized, you know, you start seeing things that show up later in your life. And a couple of things that came to mind last week when Teresa was talking, she was talking about how they managed to get money together for a set of encyclopedias. So we also had a set of Encyclopedia Britannica, and along with that came a set of Childcraft books. Any of you remember those? Each book in that set was about a different subject matter. And there was one book in that set that I looked at over and over and over, and it had to do with, I think it was called something like Customs and Cultures. And I looked at that over and over. I just thought it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And also, we always had National Geographic magazine coming, so I would look through there, and with that, you are sent a world map. So I would get out the world map, spread it out on the floor very often, and look through, just spend a lot of time absorbed and looking. I became a map geek and just had my interest built up in things beyond the U.S.
Yeah, fantastic. And we'll get to how that played out mm-hmm. in your later years here in just a moment. So what challenges, were there specific challenges that you faced as a child?
I would say, I think for the most part, I had a really supported, good childhood. There was a challenge and I bring this up. I was thinking about how to talk about this because I'm not looking to throw somebody under the bus. But one thing that I ran into growing up in my house was that. It was not unusual to come home and find my mom in bed and having spent a good share of the day in bed, and or come home and find that she had been ruminating on something, either something that was going on at the time or very often things that happened in the past. But so often we would end up across the table from each other with me listening to her, and sometimes up to a couple hours. And that started probably from the time I was 11 or 12. So I became her ear. and not a real healthy thing for a parent-child relationship, but it, I say this just in terms of how it, that was an early development of me toward things I do now. Mm-hmm. It plays out differently when I'm working with a client now in mental health. I'm not sitting there saying nothing, but I realized that very early on that she was depressed, and I didn't realize it at the time. We didn't talk about it in the 70s, but I learned very early on how to listen and how to be with someone.
Yeah, you can really see aspects of your childhood playing out through your life. Who maybe had the biggest influence on you when you were young?
I think outside of my parents, there was my sister. Some of you have met her, Judy. She's at the other end of the family, and she was almost 14 when I was born. So she got married when I was 6, and then we lived, you know, we were in Forest Grove, they were in Hillsborough, so not too far away. I would see her fairly frequently. And, you know, when you're a girl growing up, someone who's a young adult female, you're kind of, wow, you know, looking up to them. And she was my sister and loved me. And so she was a big influence. And I would also say that youth pastors were a big deal for me. We were always very involved in church activities, and I really enjoyed youth group. So we had a particular youth pastor I had in high school was named Dave, and he was a youth magnet. Our youth group grew exponentially. We had one retreat that we took to Camp Wainema on the coast, and for whatever reason, maybe it was just the only time that camp was available, but it was planned the same weekend as prom. And we ended up with 100 kids deciding to go with us to this retreat instead of staying back to go to the prom. So, it was a great time. And the athletic boys really were drawn to him because he was athletic. But then he, for some reason, there was a connection between him and me. And I really grew a lot in the Word, in my knowledge of it, and in my faith during that time. And then he left, and there was a couple that came, and that youth minister was not, he didn't connect with the kids in the same way, but he was married, and I was close to his wife. So, again, youth pastors factored big.
Yeah. So you're giving us a little bit of insight into some of your faith journey. So it sounds like you grew up going to church from a very young age, and mm-hmm. So how did that kind of shape you and form faith in you? Or did you sense a personal faith of your own? Was it?
Yeah, I was always open, listening. I remember during my grade school years, we were going to Hillsborough Friends Church, and I remember at some point when I was about 6, that the minister came and talked to our children's church, and he explained about how to accept Christ, and I think in my 6-year-old brain, I took it as that would make Jesus happy, and, you know, it comes with eternal life. Why wouldn't I want that? So I raised my hand during prayer, but there was not really a follow-up specifically to that. Continued to go to church, and then when I was 12, during sixth grade, we stopped going there. We switched to a Baptist church in Forest Grove, and they decided to not have a VBS, but to send the kids out to Camp Tillicum. And so went out there, and it was during that week I realized, there really is a choice to this. You know, you don't just have it. You're not forced into this. It's not just dumped on your leg. You're not born into it, or, you know. So I made a decision during that week, yes, that this was something that I wanted for myself, and prayed to receive Christ, and then grew from there with the youth programs that I mentioned. And then as an adult, we I would say probably what has grown that more than anything was during our time living in Nairobi. We were in Nairobi for over 10 years, and I was involved with a group of women there called, that they called themselves Women at 10. We met at 10 o'clock on Thursday mornings, and it was, there was Bible study to it, but it was also really, it was very different than a typical Bible study. It was really spiritual formation, and we, in addition to the Bible, we read great works written by different saints of the faith back into, you know, like early Teresa of Avila and, you know, St. John of the Cross and these different people. A lot of materials, if you're familiar with the Renovare publications, we went through some of those. We went read Celebration of Discipline also. And so I think, and the composition of our group was that we were coming from many countries and many different roads of the Christian faith. So each person brought their kind of their different flavor of what they knew of their Christian walk. And so it really grew me into really looking more at my faith away from looking so much as at this point I prayed a prayer to more of it being a journey.
Right, right. So I'm going to just go back, and I want to come back to this. Mm-hmm. But let's go back. So you've come through your high school years, and that somewhere along the way, there's a gentleman named Dan that comes into the picture. Weave in that part of your journey.
So Dan and I met at Oregon State at the beginning. Well, we technically met, I think, my first year there. But started dating at the beginning of my junior year, his senior year, and we were involved in ministry things together. Okay. There.
And then you opened up one of those big atlases that you had, and you said, Dan, I think there's this African over here that
didn't quite work that way.
How did that come about? Because as you move into your adulthood and life, you guys left the country.
Yeah. So how that all came together is we both separately had pictured doing ministry overseas at some point. I think back into high school, I pictured at some point down the road I would be a missionary somewhere. I was picturing, like, you know, maybe I go for 2 or 3 years and do a mission, and I kind of pictured Africa. And and then, you know, got busy and stuff. And then he, as we got and became involved, what I learned about him is that he comes from a very strong mission-minded family. From his father's side, his father is one of 7 children, and 4 of those children went into missions. And that became a very big, that was big in the culture of his family, was mission work. And so that really influenced him to early, you know, from high school on, to seek how he was going to live that out. When he graduated, he first went up to Prairie Bible up in Canada for a semester, and then he went down to Ecola Bible on the coast and, you know, discovered he's not going to be a pastor. That wasn't his calling. He's very science-minded and whatever, and it, you know, eventually went into medicine. So as his 3 of his 4 medical school years were paid for by the Army. So when he graduated from medical school, he owed Army time. And so we started into those years of, we were traveling around the country, mostly on the East Coast. We spent 4 of those 7 years in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., because he was at Walter Reed. And then at the end of the 7 years, as he was going to be discharged, he had a contract with a private practice in Gresham that wanted him to come and join there. We had the contract there. All he had to do was sign it. But he went to this medical conference and ran into a man there who was representing Christian Blind Mission. And the guy wasn't there at the table. So Dan just picked up the leaflets and came home, and he sent away for, you know, his name, gave him his name, and we got a call, and it went from there. So anyway, that's how we ended up in Nairobi. That,
okay.
He was at a place called Kikuyu Hospital, which is about 20 minutes up in the hills outside of Nairobi, and it was well known for its eye work.
Okay.
And so that's where
so
he
was practicing his doctoring.
Yeah.
And what was your, how was your time spent?
So when we went there, we had our older three children. They were 7, 5, and 3. I can't believe this now when I think about it. We went sight unseen. We had never traveled overseas with them. We just, you know, got packed up our stuff, put them on a plane with us, and ended up in Africa. And they worked with us to have a house ready and a car ready and a school ready, which was big, with our two oldest being in school at that point. And so my role there was, I looked at it very much as part of the ministry, I was in a support role in the things I was doing, as, you know, not only keeping the home fires going and raising the kids, but when you living cross-culturally, you run into unusual things. And I was the troubleshooter of those things that came up. Very often things just went wrong and I had to figure it out. So that was kind of my role as we went. And a big thing that came up for me as we were deciding to go too was just realizing kind of that verse in Matthew. It's Matthew 25, and it's where Jesus is explaining to the disciples how they can, what God is expecting of us and how to live out our lives. This is my summary. And he mentions that what you do for the least of these, you do for me. And so that was very much a verse that I hung on to as we went there. So then we got there, and besides all of that I mentioned, then I was always busy in different things with the kids' school or in ministries that I came across.
So how long were you in Nairobi?
We were there for 3.5 years the first time, and then we came back, lived in Albany for 2 years, and then thinking we were going to be there the rest of our lives, and then quickly realized, no, we're going back. And so we went back to Nairobi for another 7 years.
Okay.
Better prepared the second time.
So about 12 years. So your children grew up in Nairobi.
It was really important years for them. And then, of course, we adopted our two youngest there as well during that time.
And so then you came back, that time was done, you came back and settled where?
When we came back in 2010, we first went to Kelso, Washington, and we were there for 3 years.
Okay.
And then came down here to Tigard in 2013.
Okay.
Into that yellow house that's over the back fence. We were renting there and we saw this church here and decided that way.
Yeah, there's by the white shed, on the far side of the white shed, there's a gate that's kind of blocked off now, but that's where they lived. And
yeah. So we decided to walk to church.
Yeah.
And the first Sunday we were here, Don and Mary had just gone to Kenya. They'd just gotten back from Kenya. And Grace Kuto came up in front with Don and just said, you know, they were, or actually, I don't know if you came up, but you were mentioning that Sunday that you'd just gotten back. And the next Sunday, you were going to be presenting your pictures and everything with. And so we thought, oh, we got to, you know, we got Kenyan kids. We got to come see these people. And we saw about your trip. And
wow. I did not know that. That's fantastic. So since you've been back, you have continued to live out your faith in maybe a new way, different way than...
Yeah.
Tell us about...
So as we were coming back, in 2010 when we came back, our oldest Amy was halfway through college. Brian was going to start college. And then the other three were high school, middle school, elementary. with Grace, the youngest. She was going into third grade at that point. Well, still young, but they were all old enough that they were not needing my hands on like they did earlier, and I was seeing, you know, the years coming. Okay, what's going to be my role once I go back to the U.S.? And praying about that, just sense that I was heading toward working with adoptive families. Because of our own experiences and walking through things with friends of ours. And so I was kind of picturing that maybe I would be working with an adoption agency at some point. So our first year back, I really just concentrated on trying to settle us all in, because it was a huge thing to come back into the States, make a stable place for us as a family. So I really did, that's what I did that first year. I volunteered like once a week in Grace's school library. Other than that, I really concentrated on just making things stable at home. And then a year into our being back, I started an online program for a Master of Social Work at the University of New England. But in looking through programs, that was what was going to work with how our lives were. I didn't have to be online with anybody at any particular time. And it was turned out to be a great program. It prepared me really well, but toward the later years of that, they had it set up for one class at a time over a period of 4 years. Normally, if you do a master's full-time, you can do it in a couple years, but this was spread out, so I managed to cram a four-year program into 5 years, because I took a couple leaves of absence during summer breaks and things, just to be able to do it with around the demands that of family. And toward the later year part of that, just realize, you know, one of our kids was having some struggles, and one day in a counselor's office, it just hit me what a privilege it would be to be that third person working with families. And so I went took some more clinical sorts of classes and finished off with that leaning, and my internship, my last internship was with a community mental health clinic in Southeast Portland that focuses on children and their families, and it went from there. So then that agency hired me on when I graduated, and that's where I have spent the last many years, and ended up going from giving therapy to then supervising the clinic in Beaverton for the last few years of that, and then moved away from that a little over a year ago. I left there and started my own part-time practice, downsized to half-time now.
Yeah, and you did some teaching in there. Am I right on that?
Only fall semester of last year. Okay. I taught at George Fox. But then that was, I started teaching just before my stepmother died, dad's needs are higher, so I didn't continue with the teaching.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then most recently, I know you've gotten involved in a ministry out in Michigan, which kind of, I think, blends sort of the social work counseling side of things and your missionary experience, your overseas experience.
Yeah.
And kind of brings that all full circle, maybe.
Yeah, so as I was thinking about leaving the clinic and going out on my own, I was trying to figure out what I should be doing. And as part of that, I came across a conference called Mental Health and Missions. And they do this every November. And so went to this thing and met these people with a ministry in Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan. And the ministry is called Alongside. And it's a counseling ministry focused on missionaries and clergy. So what they do is they run 3-week intensives. You know, people apply to come to this and they decide whether they're fit or not, but they use therapists who are Christian and have missions background themselves. And because of its intensive nature, it really moves things along pretty quickly. They're not cured at the end of it, but they are in a much different place to where they can go on from there with somebody else. And so, yeah, I spent the last two Novembers, I went to that conference, and so then they need, because it's intensive, they give each of their staff a month off each at some point in the year, and they need guest therapists to come in. So that's why I ended up in Michigan in August, was I was filling in with them.
Right, so you were in Michigan alongside ministry, supporting those that were, how many attend, how many?
There were about 20 adults that came, there were 21 adults. Three of them were single women, the rest were married couples. And then there's a children's program too, so whole families come, and there were probably 17 kids there, I think.
Okay. And coming from all areas of the world?
Oh, you're showing it right there. There were, interestingly, in this cohort that was there last month, there were a number of missionaries to Muslim countries. That seems to be a growing, growing area.
Do you want to say anything about
those photos? Yeah, so the reason there's words on here is I just took it off the pictures off their website. That's an overview. You can see in the upper left is the original house that they bought. You can see all the woods. It was a property of 125 acres that they came by. So it started with that house, and there's a couple buildings to the right of that that are, go ahead, and if you can show the next one, that's the main house. They call it the Ministry Center, and the next picture is the back side of that. There's a hill. And so I was on one of those, my office was one of those lower windows there. And in the next picture, this is one of the two lodges. They have accommodated these two lodges that have five or six apartments each in them. So while people are there, they have their own apartment. There's certain hours that you're working with them, and then they have their own time. They can function with their family as they see fit. They try to give them a generous amount of time to also just rest. So that's one of the lodges. And the next one that shows, they have done things very nicely there. They're very nice accommodations. This is generally what the kids' rooms look like. And they're very detail-minded. You can see here the toys that are there. Alongside has some really committed groups of volunteers that focus on different areas. And one of their volunteer groups comes in, you know, I said they mentioned 3 weeks they're there, and then the ministry has a week off, and they turn over all the apartments, all the bedding and everything. And during that time, one of the volunteer groups, their focus is on the setting the apartments up for the kids. So they will be given the sexes and ages of the kids that are going to be staying in there. And they come in with age-appropriate toys and things. They have stuffies on the beds and just try to make it feel like home and have some things there for them in that way. And the next one, so this is the fourth building that's on the property. This is their newest building. They call it the barn. And it never was a real barn, but they made it look like that. And inside there, I think you can see in the next one, this is one of the main children's program rooms. They have the children's program based out in the barn. They have, they take littles. The bulk of the kids were in grade school, and then they have some people who focus on the teens. So there are about four of those that were there. And the kids are learning some of the things the adults are learning. Because in the adult program, they go through a couple seminars every morning of subject matter related to either mental health or how that look, needs of ministry families and so forth. But the kids are learning some similar things so that families leave with similar vocabulary, having learned some similar things and going out on the same page. So this is one of those rooms. And then the next, I don't remember what the next picture, oh, that might be it. So in that barn is the children's program as well as a couple more apartments. One of those apartments can accommodate a family of 10. occasionally you get those. And yeah. And then the silo that's on the building is not a real silo. It has a spiral staircase, and up at it takes you up to those two apartments. And if you go on up to the top of it, there's just a little bit of seating up at the top of that, and that's a prayer spot. So there's a playground outside there. There's about 5 miles worth of trails through the woods. I was staying with a couple whose house is adjacent to the back end of the whole property. And so as I went to work every morning, I had a little 10-minute walk through the woods, and lots of deer. I startled deer different times on my walk through there. Yeah,
we're grateful you came back.
So it was a really,
remarkable time. Would like to. I really can kind of see how, you know, growing up in a family where faith was central, and an atlas, and even the listening ear that you provided, really kind of shaped and directed you overseas to Nairobi, and then back, and then into social work, and then living that out, and now with your work with Alongside, and all along the way, your heart for your family and caring for them, foremost.
Yeah, and I'll be going. We're talking about my going a couple times a year to these fill-ins
to Alongside to Michigan. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you, Sally, for coming and sharing with us today. It's been lovely, and again, you know, as you go into this week, be thinking about, you know, what have I heard today? We'll post this up probably on Wednesday, and so if you want to go back and have another listen, you can. What inspires me? What motivates me? What did I hear today that challenges me? And then out of that, what can you take from today that you might take hold of, incorporate into your own life, and all of it aimed toward love and good deeds, which are very evident in the work you've been doing. So thank you. Appreciate you being here today. Roger?
I invite you to stand as we sing our closing song, Shout to the Lord.